a victory of socialism or the victory of the universal homogeneous state is a kind of extension of democratic yearnings. But what it would mean would be making the world safe for the little fat man, because everything we would be cared for. We would be like Nietzsche's last men. It's another way to put it. And so it's not so much that socialism can't work, he argues, but it is that it could work, and the sorts of things that could happen would be a disaster. This is not Marxism, but a generally more egalitarian society. And so he also takes note, however, of the fact that in the wake of the weakness of liberal democracy, I mean, there's also anti-communism that's taking place in the 30s in Europe and in England. In light of the weakness, perceived weakness of liberal democratic societies, like look at Weimar, for instance, and in light of the brand new, vibrant movement represented by fascism, that fascism itself has this capacity to seduce the best and the brightest, not the authoritarian personalities, but there's something about it that bespeaks a whole new era with new creativity. You know, Leni Riefenstahl's movie about the Nazis is called Triumph of the Will. And while liberal democracy or democracy seems to be promising, you know, caretakership, the fascism seems to be promising struggle, heroism, being a knight in the service of a high ideal, something beyond our material self-interest. All of this, of course, is well before perhaps the reality of the Nazi experiment became clear. But in light of the fact, well, in light of this fact, some very sober-minded people seemed ready to walk away from liberal democracy. And one of the things that I really liked the most that Mr. Kimball told us in his address is to remember what an amazing thing the liberal democratic society in the United States, as supported by a constitution, by our constitution, is. And so that's where I would like to end up, that limited government must be limited by the necessities that it faces in any given era, and it must be guided by our principles of justice. But I wondered whether even... I wondered whether even de Juvenal was able fully to appreciate, you know, he complains that France thought it could imitate the separation of powers and it could have a formal constitution and everything would be hunky-dory. But no, there needs to be cultural formations, there need to be social powers and associations in support of that formality. But when you look at the United States, especially in the structural parts of the Constitution and in the federal principle where you see limited government enshrined, the question for me is how can we continue to keep that working, that in a sense we've seen in the Second World War, we've seen in the War on Terror, that liberal democracy is not unequal to the challenges that it faces. At least it hasn't been so far. So for me, I would like to have a version of limited government as we have known it preserved. In order to do that, I guess I'd place my money, just some money, on education. On education about the Constitution, and education, a political civic education, as important to help us preserve what deserves to be preserved.
Thanks, Pamela. We're kind of over the time where we should be asking questions. Do you want to talk quickly, Kevin?
I can.
Okay, Jennifer. You do want to talk, or you want to answer questions?
I would like to talk.
You talk, Jennifer. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I know that's a surprise. Okay, so I think the major challenge to the project of limiting government is that most people are no longer actually convinced that we need to limit government. And Mike spoke of the people's romance with the government in terms of being so impressed with its power to do immense projects. But I think the real problem is actually the people's romance with themselves as voters, and that people have been fed this belief that as voting citizens, we have some control over the political process, and this is just false. It's not at all accurate. The problem of concentrated benefits, dispersed costs, the problem of special interests, log rolling, all of the different political mechanisms that are used to actually create law mean that as average citizens, we have absolutely no impact on the political process at all. Who actually ends up having impact is simply large groups of special interests, right? As average people, the common good is never at all even in the discussion. And so what I think is that what we need to do, if we want to really limit government, that what we need to start thinking about is how to master or muster, I should say, the will of the common people. And by that, I mean all of us who don't have some massive stake in a government transfer, because we are not going to have a chance if we continue to be fed the line that as voters, simply as voters, we are exercising some sort of power. It's just false, right? And this belief that we even pass on to our students, or some people do, I don't, that, you know, you have to vote in order to participate in the discussion. It's false. You can participate in the discussion even if you don't vote. And voting doesn't grant you any power or any special right either. It doesn't do anything but legitimate the system that is pretending as if you have some power because you voted, right? So I think actually the if you want a real radical solution to this problem is that fewer of us should vote. We should tell fewer of our students to vote, and not just that we should make it quite clear that we are not fooled by this chicanery. This magic show that somehow my putting one vote into a pool of 150 million indicates that I have some power. This is a lie, right? The only power that we have as citizens is the Constitution, and we are foregoing that for some sort of pretend voting power.
Always at my back, I hear time swing, a chariot hurrying near. That's an extraordinary way to end a conference on government. Let's go to questions from the audience.
Max Schnibben, Hamilton College. The final piece of the reading that we had for this colloquium was a piece by Juvenal on the myth of the solution, how governmental solutions are not like geometric problems. This is actually somewhat similar, I think, to Hayek's issues with central planning, but we're also seeing the growth of big data. There was a great New York Times piece a month or two ago about how we're living in a more and more data-based world, where it almost seems possible, once again, that we can find solutions through data alone, that central planning may work in ways that Juvenal and Hayek may not have envisioned. Is this true? Can we really use data in the 21st century with the technology we have to achieve central planning solutions? Or if we can't, how do we draw the line, and how do we properly integrate data in our attempts for a solution, if not the solution?
Lane?
I would suggest that even technology isn't going to undermine the argument that Hayek made, for the simple reason that imagine the most comprehensive kind of monitoring system. You've had a chip implanted, and it will say whether or not your left toe is itching, or if you need to blow your nose, or if you're feeling slightly warm around your right ring finger. It's still, until and unless it can actually read your mind, then it will not have the diffuse knowledge about your plans and your priorities and your wishes that enter into those market decisions. And if it did, then, though I'm reluctant to invoke a transcendental power, heaven help us.
Mike.
I go on top of that. Hayek also said even if you could read your mind, the yeah. acting in a market process generates knowledge that's not even yeah. in your mind yet, so you couldn't even get that in the data.
That's right.
Okay. Eric.
Eric Filipiak, the Theodore Eismeyer Fellow here at the Alexander Hamilton Institute. Two things. First, maybe I missed it when Jennifer, James, and Mike were talking about information asymmetries, but I think that the concept you were looking for was adverse selection. Maybe I missed it. If I did, forgive me, it's different than Merle has it, as I understand it. Secondly, I wanted to turn to the issue of whether or not this legal challenge to Obamacare would pass muster, because I grant you it's distinctly different from whether or not it's constitutional. And we can assume that you could reason your way to this law being unconstitutional, that Anthony Kennedy could wake up as a Republican on the day on which he happens to cast his vote, but there still seems to be this issue of politics involving the court when it casts its decision and how this goes over. And what I'm thinking of is the strategy involved on the part of the justices, because if you have any familiarity with con law, you know, much of the cases involve the court really going after actions of the state governments. And in fact, when the court goes after actions of the other branches within the federal government, the results historically tend not to be so good. And we can forget about the 1800s, just worry about the 20th century and the first decade or so in this century. And you see in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, the few times that the court did overturn acts of Congress, congressmen got very indignant, and they were minor legislative actions. And one wonders if the court were to overturn any part of Obamacare, what the reaction? Are we looking at another court packing plan? Are we looking at another confrontation with the court, the likes of which FDR had? And I wonder, those of you with any knowledge of con law, what your thoughts on that are and the strategy involved amongst the justices.
Go ahead.
Well, Obama got himself into a little bit of trouble, right, when he sort of quasi-attacked the court and said that it should defer to Congress. And I think some of what you say is a little overstated, because you know, each party seems to flip back and forth between advocating judicial restraint, right, and accusing the court of judicial activism, but it's used in a kind of hypocritical way. If they disagree, then they accuse the court of judicial activism. If they you know, and vice versa. So I would be surprised if anything remarkable happened either in Congress or on Obama's part, even if the thing is ruled unconstitutional. And just let me make one more point quickly about Kennedy. What came up in the argument that was interesting, right, is that in the 20th century, since Wickard v. Filburn, the test has been, does this activity that so-and-so or something is engaged in have a substantial effect on interstate commerce, right? The effects test. That's been what they've used to rule. And so for the first time, they're presented with the effect is regulated to someone not doing anything. And Kennedy seized on that. And so if you approve the idea that someone not doing anything has an effect on interstate commerce, what's the limiting principle going forward, right? Then it's hard to know what the Commerce Clause means at all, how it could be used as any kind of limitation on if inactivity affects interstate commerce, right? Then where would you find the limit? And Kennedy seized on that, so I think that you know, might be telling.
I'm Paul Williams. I'm just a citizen.
question is, in my mind, is healthcare a human right? I believe that healthcare is a human right, the same as security, food, shelter, education, perhaps. And if healthcare is a human right, the only thing that can really do help it and make it work, it seems to me, is the government. And there seems to be consensus up there that that the healthcare system is a shambles. It needs fixing. And so we try to do little things here and there to fix it. But I don't think it can be done that way. And I don't think it can be done with Obamacare either, particularly because it's a mess. And I hear a lot about liberty up there, and I wonder about the liberty is, and this is kind of, is it a liberty to get sick and maybe die from sickness? I don't know. But I don't think anyone up there believes that healthcare is a human right. And am I right about that? That's my question.
I think you're right. Elaine?
Healthcare is not a human right, I would maintain. If healthcare were a human right, along with the other positive features that you mentioned, that presupposes that these are all things that have material prerequisites. They require goods of various sorts in order to be made operational. Where are those going to come from? The only way you're going to get them is by taking them from other people. If you believe healthcare is a right, I would maintain, and this is slightly hyperbolic, but only slightly, you also believe in slavery. Slaving the people who are going to have to provide the wherewithal to provide you with the right.
Do you understand the distinction that she's drawn?
It's hard for me to understand, but I get it.
But could we ask you, I mean, one of the questions I had raised is, how do you determine what is a human right and what is not a human right? So when you make a statement that you think it is a human right, could you just give us your reasoning as to why you think it is when, for example, the Declaration of Independence lists life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? And, you know, many people have then gone on to say education is a right, health insurance is a right. This is sort of a joke, but I mean, I heard that the German welfare state says sexual satisfaction is a right, and therefore men have a right to Viagra. I mean, that's not a joke. I've heard that, right? In other words, that when you start, how do you determine what is a right and what is not a right?
Well, it seems to me that health is something that everyone in the country suffers from, bad health or good health. And health needs to be fixed. Bad health needs to be fixed. And an awful lot of people are not able to do that in the system that we have because they can't afford it. And that creates a problem. It seems to me that there is a right that people should to have health care. And I think that most of the major countries in the world seem to agree with that, and I don't think that's a strange thing to think, but maybe in this room it is.
I think that using the adjective human to qualify the word right suggests that kind of right trumps other kinds of rights.
I don't mean that.
Oh. Let me rephrase that. If something is a human right, then the government is acting legitimately to transfer some of my wealth to someone else in order that person can enjoy that product.
Along with you enjoy it.
Pardon me?
You can enjoy it as well.
I can enjoy it, but I would prefer, and I think I should, provide for it myself, not by using the arm of the government to transfer wealth from you.
Well, I don't know how that you would fix it for yourself, but if you decide...
I do it by saving.
If you want to have insurance on yourself, then you can certainly do that.
Yes, I can, and I would. But not by using the government to transfer wealth from you to me.
Well, the government isn't necessarily doing it. If it can be sustained, through if everyone has to take a part, and I believe that's one of the secrets of the thing, that not a secret, but that makes it possible, is everyone is paying into the healthcare system because they're all taking part in the healthcare system. And if this is maybe a side effect, but it seems to me that it makes it constitutional, since everyone is already taking part in the healthcare system when they're born and when they have a pediatrician and so on. So they're all in the healthcare system. And that's separate from the insurance healthcare system. And so to ask people who are already in that system to pay for it through healthcare is, to me, reasonable and constitutional.
Persons are not necessarily in the healthcare system. I would guess that there are some persons who will deal with the pain from inflamed gallbladders rather than have the gallbladder excised. If I am required to participate, that destroys my liberty.
Where were you born?
Rochester.
In a hospital?
I believe so, yes.
Then you're a member of the healthcare system.
Wait a minute. Because my parents chose to go to the hospital or have my mother go to the hospital rather than I be born at home or with a midwife.
Did you have a broken leg or anything that might have been fixed in a hospital?
I've had some things fixed in the hospital, yes. How did I pay for it? With premiums that I paid out of my wages. I did not rely on Mother Bernadette.
Jennifer, did you want to make a quick comment?
Yeah, I just want to. I'm gonna try to take your part here, and so I'm going to say that let's imagine that healthcare is, well, let's just say that, let's grant that healthcare is a right and that it is a positive right, so it implies an obligation on someone else's part if you can't provide it for yourself, right? There's no real debate or there's no real problem or controversy if you can provide your own healthcare, right? Fine, we all play into it and we all get back out of it, kind of like Social Security maybe. Everybody gets what they put in, if that's, you know, the ideal. Then there's no, it's not as big of a, as big of an issue. The real issue I think that you're actually bringing up is that there are people who cannot provide health care for themselves, right? And those are the people that we need to worry about, not just need to, that we're obligated to worry about, right? If you cannot pay for your own health care, then the rest of us who are out there buying, I just bought another pair of shoes right yesterday, and I'll probably buy another pair tomorrow, right? Instead of worrying about someone else's health care, which I should be doing because I have an obligation to them, because I'm a human being and they're a human being and I can afford it and they can't, right? So the problem with that kind of thinking is that all of us here then are just evil, and everyone in the United States is pretty much evil, and we're all failing in our obligations to human beings, because on this planet there are literally billions of people that are starving to death currently at this very moment that we could be saving. All of us could be spending less money. All right, not coming here. This is a luxury. Look at us. We're acting ridiculously, right? This is a luxury. We sitting here talking about this is a luxury. I could be working right now producing bread for some poor Indian child to eat, right? And I'm not, and you're not, right? And none of the people that want nationalized health care are either, right? So they don't really think that we have an obligation to each other, not like that. Right, or not in any real sense. All right, so this is sort of a false belief, I think.
Okay.
This may or may not be an interesting question, but I'm curious, why is this bill so big? I mean, it's 2,700 pages long. I have a copy of the National Industrial Recovery Act with me, and it's only about 30 or 40 pages. I realized there was more to it than that once they actually implemented the code. But is this a result of political strategy, or is it a legal consequence of where we've come since then? I'm just interested on your thoughts on the size of the bill.
Charles.
I think this goes to Jen's point, actually, a little bit, when she talked about how it can be irrational to vote. It's so long, I think, because it can be so long. Incentives that went into writing the bill came from all directions, and very few of them had anything to do with the overall good. So I think it's long because there's an opportunity for it to be.
Tiffany.
There's a lot of resources available.
I don't know about the particular strategy behind this particular bill, but in general, You referenced the National Industrial Recovery Act, and if you go back to New Deal era statutes that in which Congress delegated power, and in that case that was delegation run riot, as one member of the court characterized it. But the bill is very short. It's very sweet in the sense in which we're identifying this problem. We claim the authority under the Constitution to address it, and we are expressly delegating that to the president and his subordinates. Long about the 1960s, and that's generally referred to as broad. I think it's broad delegation, because in effect Congress gives a very wide discretion to the administrators. That began to fall out of favor around the 1960s, in part because members of Congress wanted to create more of an appearance of doing something than they really were. And so they began to delegate more narrowly. The Clean Air Act is an example of this, in which the Congress sets out a very elaborate schedule of things to be done that looks like it's actually getting serious about regulating, when even in reality it's not. That's not the way the administrative agency is actually going to be able to implement it. But at least in that shift, there's a book you might want to consult on this point. It's called Power Without Responsibility by a law professor who was actually one of the founding members of the Natural Resources Defense Council, who came to dislike delegation by virtue of having to try to make the EPA live up to what appeared to be the requirements of the Clean Air Act. But he has a nice discussion of this in that book, The Shift from the New Deal Era to the 1960s.
Elaine, I'm going to go back to the audience if we can. Is there another question?
Hi. I'm wondering, what advice, if any, do you have for a young person who might be inclined to agree with you that we need limited government, we need to understand the founding and so forth, but nevertheless feels helpless in the face of this monolith of liberal relativism, statism, progressivism, and so forth?
Jim, it's all yours.
Create a diversified portfolio of common stocks and bet against the government every chance you get.
Kevin.
Society's always bad. It's always good. I mean, this is nothing new. In a way, there's no reason to kind of be excessively pessimistic about the world that we live in. Things are always getting better and getting worse, as Peter Lawler has said. It doesn't obviate you ever in any society from the task to know what's best for you as an individual. And that's not just satisfying your preferences. I mean, as the Beastie Boys say, I like my sugar with coffee and cream. But is that good, right? The only way to fully liberate yourself from the tyranny of convention, from the tyranny of kind of your times, from the tyranny of the state. So I would go even farther than Mike and say, don't worry about the state. Don't worry about what society tells you to be like. Right? The task of self-knowledge is always yours as an individual. And that's the only way that you're really free, not just free to do what you want. So for anyone who's interested in limiting government at the end, I guess that really means getting your own house in order. And that's something you have to do for yourself.
A very quick comment.
Yeah, very brief comment is that nothing is inevitable in history and in politics. I mean, the myth of inevitability is really one of the most powerful things that it drives the modern belief in progress. And we've seen so many times swings of the pendulum in history. In another 5 years, when, you know, the deficits get bigger and people sober up and so on, you may see pendulum swings. Communism fell. People didn't expect that to happen. So the myth of inevitability, just think that through. And the other thing is the comment I made before. Politics is not the most important thing. You can dedicate your life to matters of the mind, the spirit, and the heart, which are way beyond politics, and they'll always be there for you.
One more question.
Patrick English, Hamilton College. You guys touched on this earlier, but the U.S. spends a lot more on healthcare than most of Europe, and it results in a lot less quality than most of Europe. So why does the U.S. spend so much, and what are some ways to cut back while keeping the same level of quality or higher quality?
Mike.
Well,
He's got the numbers, Elaine. He's got the numbers.
I promised I didn't want to get into a discussion of what reforms I had. Again, there's two famous. Every time you raise that question, people will pull out two famous studies: the RAND study and the recent Medicaid study. I forget who the authors were. The RAND study, run in the 70s, was, look, let's give people different amounts of money to spend on healthcare and see if we get different outcomes. And I'm simplifying a lot, but there was a lot of wasteful spending. In other words, there were groups of people where we cut their spending by half and they didn't get any measurable change in outcomes. And then we look at differences in Medicaid reimbursements across states, and some states are notoriously stingy as compared to others. And at the margin, they weren't getting worse outcomes than the states that spend a lot more. So that's where the idea would come from, that you can cut a lot of fat. I would suggest that you don't want to just look at outcomes as terms of life expectancy. So we don't have a good understanding of how comfortable we are in our last 10 years of life. People in America spend a lot less time dying than people in other countries. That doesn't enter the healthcare statistics. People in America like the idea that they can get a 10th MRI just because their eye doesn't quite feel right. And I don't know how to put a number on whether that's good or bad. And I would also suggest that if you look at actual economic cost and not numbers on expenditures, we spend less than almost any other Western country on our healthcare system. Look at the resources that are going into the healthcare system, not the actual green pieces of paper that we spend on it, and you'll look at we're pretty efficient in very many of the areas where it looks like we're not. And again, that's a longer discussion. So in terms of reform, real quick, you know, Jim has mentioned some, you know, deregulating and allowing insurance to be sold across state lines, ending the idea of guaranteed issue, right? Ending the idea of community rating, end of the idea of mandated minimum coverages. I mean, this would just be a start. And certainly a thoughtful proposal out. That's very radical, but, you know, something that was in the McCain plan when he was running was a very sensible one. Just end the employer tax subsidy. And no Republican. They all have to sign the American for Tax Reforms, no tax increase thing. But I guarantee if you sort of end that tax break, you'll end up paying less in taxes over the next 10 or 20 years. But it looks like a tax increase, so no Republican can ever say end that tax preference. I would go there. If I were running, that's the only thing I'd run on, first of all, because I think you can get broad support for that kind of a reform, and it would bring down spending a little bit. But I suggest we may not get a meaningful reduction.
Jennifer.
I just tricked you, because I'm not going to answer this question, but I want to answer the previous one. So I just want to say, don't you dare listen to what they said. Don't look outside of politics. Don't look outside of our responsibility to the social order. I want you and all of these students in here to take the responsibility of making sure that we have a world that is worth living in, and not to feel defeated. At the time that the Founding Fathers were debating our Constitution, they noted that the science of politics had come a long way, basically, since the Greek experiment, right? And that's true now. It's come a long way, right? And it takes entrepreneurial ideas. It takes new thinkers. It takes people looking at things in different ways to find solutions to the problems that continue to come up. But don't think that they don't exist. And don't think that you don't have the responsibility to find them. You do. Right, and it's fulfilling, and we should want to change the world, and we should want to save the world, and that's why we're here. So all of us, despite what we do to keep ourselves going, that's why we're here, right, is to make the world a better place. So don't be afraid of that.
Every moderator wants to end any kind of colloquium discussion with the Beastie Boys, but unfortunately that moment passed, so we'll end with a stirring message instead. I just want to take the moment to thank the panel for making my job so much easier the last couple of days, and to thank the audience also for your participation and excellent questions. And thanks. This has been a very nice couple of days.
May we also thank our incredible discussion leader.
And let's not forget to thank Chris Hill for moderating the discussion and keeping the discussion lively.
And thank the AHI for sponsoring it.
And if you can't...
There's nothing that can't be done.
If you can't smell it, it's next door.
Oh, dinner's next door.
That's where the...
I know. Another one. I was going to say... That's what you were going to look at.